This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
How much do you worry about possibly going back to prison?
If they will arrest me, they will arrest me, I will go there. If they will assassinate me, I will be assassinated, but I have to go ahead with my struggle.
Rwandan opposition leader Victoire Ingabire has been rearrested in Kigali.
No war with Iran!
No war with Iran!
Stop arming Israel!
Stop arming
Protesters rally at the White House to demand no war on Iran.
This kind of strike is important because it has mainly political demands, which is to say it deals with the requests and the needs, the immediate needs of the workers, but it has to be understood in a broader perspective.
Italian workers hold a day of general strike to protest the genocide in Gaza and the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran.
People of the world, the eyes of the world need to be on St. Louis. What is happening in St. Louis right now is extremely serious and extremely urgent. It is Katrina all over again. It is a land grab in progress. And everybody, in particular speaking to white people, need to do everything we can to support the African community here, to stand in solidarity with the right of African people to stay in their communities.
The city of St. Louis is using tornado destruction to displace black communities. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Rwandan opposition leader Victoire Ingabire has once again been arrested in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. Pacifica's Anne Garrison reports.
Last week, Victoire Ingabire was summoned to a Rwandan court to testify in the case of seven political dissidents and one journalist, Theoneste Nsengimana, who are on trial for organizing resistance to the Rwandan government and for possessing Blueprint for Revolution, a guidebook for nonviolent political protest. The dissidents and the journalist were in pretrial detention, awaiting trial for 3 years, between 2021 and 2024. Ingabire is now under arrest as well, accused of leading and conspiring with them. Back in January 2010, Ingabire returned from exile in the Netherlands to attempt to run against Rwandan President Paul Kagame, who has been in power for over 30 years. She was never allowed to register her political party or stand as a candidate, and neither were Kagame's other two serious challengers that year. In October that year, she was arrested, and in 2013, she was handed a 15-year prison sentence for allegedly minimizing the Rwandan genocide and organizing armed resistance to the government, though she denied both charges. The accusation that she had minimized the Rwandan genocide stemmed from her appearance at Kigali's genocide memorial, where she asked where the memorial to the Hutus was. In Rwanda, the genocide against the Tutsi is the legally codified and enforced description of the country's 1994 tragedy. During that year, while attempting to run for president, Ingabire said that Hutu people were also killed before, during, and after the genocide, often in what were crimes against humanity. In 2017, the African Court of Human and People's Rights ruled that Rwanda had violated Ingabire's rights to free expression according to the African Charter on Human and People's Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. They ordered Rwanda to free her and pay restitution, including her legal costs. A year later, President Kagame granted her clemency, but still confined her within the borders of Rwanda. She formed a new political party and attempted to run for president in 2024, but once again, the government neither allowed her to register her party nor allowed her to run. The U.S. National Basketball Association has formed a special relationship with Rwandan President Paul Kagame, but it has been questioned by sports writers, including David Zirin. In July 2024, ESPN released its investigative documentary, How the NBA Got Into Business with an African Dictator, which includes this interview with Ingabire.
Victoire Ingabire is an opposition leader in a country with very little opposition. When we spoke at her home in Kigali, she said she's under constant surveillance and forbidden to leave the country.
We needed a stronger man after the genocide against the Tutsis to have order in our country. But now, we need strong institution, not a stronger man.
The U.S. and other Western governments say Ingabire is one of several opposition figures who've been unjustly arrested and harassed. Others fled the country, disappeared, or were killed.
Every time we had a presidential election, if there was someone who wanted to participate against President Kagame, this person was arrested.
Ingabire tried to run against Kagame in 2010, but was arrested before the election, released, then arrested again after Kagame won. After a trial that human rights groups called unjust, she was sentenced to 15 years for crimes against the government. The first 5 years you were in solitary confinement?
Yes.
Were you allowed out at all?
I think the three first years, not. But the three last years, I had 3 hours in the week.
In 2018, Ingabire was pardoned after 8 years in prison. She has continued to speak out. At one point during our interview, she began to recite a list of several colleagues she says were arrested, killed, or disappeared.
My assistant, he was assassinated in March 2019. And coordinator of my political party was also assassinated in September 2019. And our representative in the eastern country is missing since July 2019.
How much do you worry about possibly going back to prison?
If they will arrest me, they will arrest me. I will go there. If they will assassinate me, I will be assassinated. But I have to go ahead with my struggle.
That was Rwandan opposition leader Victoire Ingabire speaking to ESPN for its documentary, How the NBA Got Into Business with an African Dictator. Ingabire was rearrested on June 20, and she remains in custody. Rwanda is a longstanding U.S. ally, and Kagame is a longstanding favorite at the annual World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, despite the country's repressive extremes. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
On June 18th, 4 days prior to the U.S. attack on Iran, the Answer Coalition organized an anti-war rally outside the White House. Hundreds gathered to demand no war on Iran.
So we're here to say, no war with Iran!
No war with Iran!
Stop arming Israel!
Stop arming Israel!
Stop arming Israel!
Let Gaza live!
Ready to send other people's children to die for a war they wouldn't fight in themselves. We see you and we won't forget.
Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke spoke to veteran activist and militant Star Bui about Israel, its history, and apartheid society, and the possibilities for progressive social change.
Star, why are you here today in support of the Iranian people, I assume?
I'm here in support of the Iranian people because I think that they are innocent of all of the accusations made of them of aggressively pursuing a policy of trying to destroy their neighbors by building nukes and trying to destroy the people of the United States. I think it's quite the opposite. I think the United States and its hired gun, which is Israel, have designs on the resources and the cheap labor and potential markets of Western Asia, known as also as the Middle East. And I think that they have initiated all of the problems in that region of the world. And
what's Israel's role in all this? Would you say Israel is being led by the United States and is serving as their cat's paw, so to speak, to do their dirty work? Or is instead the way it seems to be depicted by the liberals in this country, you know, Trump is too weak to not be led by the Zionists, and somehow, you know, if he was just stronger, we might actually have an American president that stood up to them. What do you say to that?
Well, what I say is that I think that the Zionists, since their their founding fathers back in the late 1800s have basically created a bargain with the devil. They, Theodore Herzl in 1897 said to the sovereigns in Europe, if you will support us, we will solve your Jewish problem for you, quote unquote, by setting up a separate state. And we will also, quote unquote, serve as an outpost of civilization against barbarism. And in return for the support of the imperialist countries, including the U.S. later on, for the Zionist project, which was to establish a Jewish state on land that they were fully aware was occupied by Palestinians, both Zionist founder Jabotinsky in the 1920s and later Israeli President Ben-Gurion, both said this land is full of people and they will not welcome our dispossessing them. So they were well aware of what they were doing, and with the backing of the imperialist powers, they have been taking the land over several decades. And in return, they perform various functions for the imperialist class. They do clandestine operations around the world. They've trained security forces. Right now, most of the kibbutzes, which were have been military outposts to further expansion on Palestinian land, they are now really little Silicon Valleys developing surveillance technology, special battlefield weaponry, all kinds of things that will help more efforts, allegedly help them around the world. And it's a very high price to pay for realizing what is a theological error and thinking that they can, that Israel and Israeli Jews are entitled to not only the land of Palestine, but to what is called Eretz Israel, which is greater Israel, and that includes parts of Lebanon, parts of Syria, parts of Iraq, and parts of Egypt. And this has a mythological, theological distortion beyond all belief.
Let me ask you this. What can American citizens, American workers do to say no to this and to say no effectively? What in your opinion?
Well, I think to be effective, you have to always arm yourself with knowledge. And I would encourage people to look at websites and podcasts and not listen to the corporate media, which will always put a face on things that makes it look like the U.S. and Israel are defending human rights and that they're being victimized by other countries, especially countries in the global south that they lose resources they want to exploit. So information is key. The other thing is that they can act through whatever organizations, particularly unions they belong in, their faith groups, their community organizations, their city councils, get resolutions passed demanding that programmatically the United States should be calling for a full, permanent, and immediate and to all aid to Israel and diplomatic cover. And by aid, it's not just a matter of, as some of the so-called peace groups say, ending the transfer of weapons to Israel. Because if Israel has billions coming in, they'll buy the money. I mean, they'll buy the weapons. So to focus on that is misleading. So you want a total cessation.
They have their own, weapons industry as well.
Well, they're pretty dependent.
Yeah.
They develop
it
for other people. They develop the plants, but they don't actually do the manufacture themselves.
Oh, I see.
Except for surveillance. So,
I'm thinking about dock strikes, for example.
Yeah,
dock workers.
Yeah. So I was going to add. So that has to be your programmatic demands, and then your. So that's your goal. And of course, you want repatriation of all the Palestinians and reparations to them and war crime tribunals for our leaders as well here in the U.S. as well as the Israeli leaders who have been part and parcel of the war crimes that have been committed over decades. All right, those are maybe your programmatic demands, but I think what you do, as you said, if you're a dock worker, don't ship things. If you're in the military, There are some groups that are courageous active duty military that are trying to organize so that they are not part and parcel of a genocide in their name when they swear to uphold the Constitution. So, you know, locate those groups and follow their lead. Organize your unions. And above all, keep in mind, once you're informed about the issues, because you'll hit opposition, you also need to really understand that it is the rich that are driving these war moves and the oppression of the workers here, because it puts money in their pockets to expand their territory for new for raw materials and markets and cheap labor sources. And those it only suppresses the standard of living of workers here. And when you have layoffs here, and you will have layoffs when they build up their inventory, it's part of capitalism. Each capitalist builds up his or her inventory. They can't move it because the markets are saturated. So they lay off people, or they speed up the workers they have. And then they basically, once you lay off all your workers, you have no consumers for their goods. And so the system goes into crisis, and it is propelled even further along the direction of acquiring more territory. And understand that fascism, which is military formation, is really an advanced stage of capitalism. It's the most advanced stage.
And the only, fascism?
Yeah, it's advanced stage of capitalism.
I thought it was capitalism in crisis. I thought it was capitalism that is willing to slaughter the workers or organize workers in order to establish a capitalist peace.
It's sort of the same.
Is this country at that stage? I mean, are the workers?
Well, I think
revolt?
That they're getting there. No,
well, let's
but
hope.
No, yeah. but fascism is actually, in a way, a mopping up operation after there has been a crisis and a defeat of the working class, and globally. There was a defeat of the working class in the fall of the Soviet Union, even though there were problems with the system there.
Oh, yeah.
But it was still a defeat because they were giving aid to various liberation struggles over decades. You know, they could have done a lot more, but they were doing. They at least held out a hope for some kind of egalitarian society where the decisions would be made on the basis of people's needs and not profits. So that was a defeat, and likewise.
Well, to the Kuwait War and then the subsequent Iraq invasion and everything since.
Yeah.
Once the Soviet Union
and everything.
Yeah.
So you have to keep that in mind. But yes, fascism is the highest stage of imperialism, but that's because at its highest stage, imperialism has succeeded in squeezing the workers so badly in the home country that they can't consume anything. So it has to expand. So it's this contradictory thing that when you're built on a fallacy, which is that you can have individual companies making decisions that affect the well-being of all, and yet they're just a tiny fraction and they're only motivated by a profit incentive. You know, you have nothing but anarchy in the decision-making as opposed to global planning, which could create a safe environment and good housing, education, medical care, shelter, transportation, all kinds of things
meet
that would benefit.
Meet the needs of the people.
Yeah, meet the needs of the people.
Of course.
That was veteran D.C.-based activist Star Bui speaking to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke last Wednesday in front of the White House.
Come, you masters of war, you that build all the guns, you that build the death blades, you that build all the guns, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, I just want you to know I can't see through your masks. You've never done nothing but to build and destroy. You play with my world as your little toy. You put a drug in my head. Then you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly.
Like Judas. That was Eddie Vedder, Masters of War. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. On June 20th, Italy saw a national general strike protesting the genocide in Gaza, the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, and the broader economic assault on the working class. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with C-COBUS logistics union leader Daniele Malamachi and International Road Transport, TIR, union member Diego Biancolin about the strike and the social conditions driving it. This marks the first national strike in Europe linking opposition to genocide, war, and the austerity imposed to fund growing military budgets.
First of all, this is a very important general strike because in recent times, here in Italy, we already had three general strikes, most of them declared by just one union organization. In this case, several union organizations, grassroots unions, have declared the general strike, so there is a larger movement than before. In the case of the 20, the most important requests are the end of the genocide in Palestine, the end of all the military defense, in particular regarding the current wars from Ukraine to Sudan, better wages, so there is a very bad problem of salary here in Italy, and also the liberty to organize on the work field and to do union activities like strikes.
And what is your organization doing? I know, are the unions, the major unions in Italy involved in the strike and struggle?
So let's say I mainly work in the political field. I am not actually in the first person on the first line when it comes to union struggles. However, it must be stressed, as Daniele already said, that this is a matter of some and the most combative grassroots unions. And so the big firms, so to speak, of traditional unions in Italy, which is CGL, CISL and UIL, do not agree to this kind of struggle. They actually side with the government and its wars. They foster such a climate so as that Italy and Italians may be more willing to join an imperialist war. And that is why this kind of strike is important, because it has mainly political demands, which is to say it deals with the requests and the needs, the immediate needs of the workers, but it has to be understood in a broader perspective within a system as a moment in the struggle against a social system and a specific social formation, the capitalist one.
And the C-COBUS is a militant independent union of logistic workers. You've had other activities against war, against U.S. military weapons coming through Italy. What does C-COBUS see in the coming period? Because, as you know, Trump has supported Meloni, the Meloni government. And what does this mean?
It's a continued activity against the war and against the economy of war. It's rapidly in preparation here in Italy, an economy of war to sustain the imperialistic Italian interest all over the world. It's a big deal, of course, in alliance with all the rest of the imperialistic powers, including the United States. It's a continuing activity because continuously there are problems on the work field. Of course, most of them related to economic needs of workers. So a good part of the activity as C-COBUS is to collect these requests, to sustain on an economic plan a fight in order to get better conditions of work and life, and to link those economic requests to more general political requests. First of all, again, to fight against war and economy of war. Just one thing, on the 20th, there will be also another union in Italy, very important, the biggest one, the CGL, in strike in the automotive sector, because the general national contract on that sector has not been renewed. So again, it's a sign that there is a large, intense problem in all working sector affecting literally most of the population. And this is why on the 20 will be a C-COBUS in action. C-COBUS is the main union in the logistics sector in Italy. We know the logistics sector is strategic for most of the other economic sectors, so it will be a strike affecting effectively the economic interest, and will be also in action with an eye to what's going on in the United States, because we know that facts occurring them regard all the working class at the world level, and they also have an important point of developing specifically regarding the unions, the workers, and taking action as workers.
And as you know, the Trump government has launched raids, called out the National Guard, the Marines, against immigrants to repress immigrants. They're raiding factories. But you and Kobus, I understand, have also faced repression attack on immigrant members of your union. What's the relationship of this attack on immigrants, both in the United States and in Italy?
Most of Sicoba's workers are immigrant workers coming from all over the world, and most of them come from countries where repression is really deeper than here in Italy, than here in Europe, and also than in the US, where the repression is higher than in Europe. This is why we know this kind of situation, not only for indirect experience of the working movement, but because of the real life experience of a lot of workers, member of the Sicoba's union. What's going on there at the government level is to try, on the one side, to prevent major protests, because doing wars everywhere in the world, trying to catch more profit everywhere in the world, in the US, is a problem today with the international crisis. So, of course, the power, also the governmental level, has to contain current protests and to prevent larger protests. This is exactly what's going on here in Italy with the current government. Meloni is the prime minister, but also with the previous government, both the ones of the left wing and both the ones of the right wing. So it's a continuous activity, not only at the legislative plan, but also at the repressive plan against workers and against all people fighting against this system. And this is why on the 20th of June we call for the general strike to a larger protest. All the workers, not only the ones in logistics organized with Sicobas, and also to all the people involved in fights here in Italy, in order to make a clear signal to this government, to the bosses, but also at the international level, that taking action is possible to sustain this current repression and to prevent deeper and deeper coup of the power.
Luigi Mangione has become a popular figure in the United States. What do you think about Luigi Mangione?
Also in Italy we have knew the story of Luigi Mangione. Of course what he did had a very large impact, not only on US society, not only for the fact that it was something related to this enormous problem of healthcare, of the right to be cured in case of necessity, but also because it was an act of reaction to this system of exploitation, oppression, especially in the US, very hard, but all over the world, not at the end in the very sense of the term, but historically in a crisis enormous.
And Sacco and Vanzetti were Italian Americans who were murdered because they were communists, they were socialists. Today, in the United States, workers are dying because they can't get health care. And also, I understand in Italy, health care is under attack here by the government.
Certainly, their story, Sacco and Vanzetti story, is still very known and very present, not only in the collective memory, also in the daily action of so many people all over the world, not only in the US, Italy. They were comrades, they were workers, they were immigrants, and their lesson still count today, both in the sense of their success and their errors, because still today repression is every day a problem for militants, for workers, for proletarians taking actions against the system.
Do you think internationalism is growing?
It's growing. At the time of Vanzetti and Sacco, probably, for what is my knowledge, was really more widespread than today, but the potential today is not comparable to the one of the time, because today we are almost 8 billion of people on Earth, divided in countries, divided by religion, divided by political opinions, but finally unified, deeply unified, but the material conditions of life. And this is the most important element as a factor of solidarity, union, and organization.
And what would you like to say to the American working class?
To be ready, because it's the time. It's a time of an historical crisis, so it's the time for the working class, the world working class, to come back in the sense of being active as unions and above all politically. And what's going on there in US, the protests from Los Angeles, California to other cities still ongoing, has a very positive effect here in Europe. So first of all, I express solidarity with all the people, workers, proletarians protesting there. I express solidarity with the organizations involved in those protests, and I hope, I warmly advise to continue this path, preparing a real big general strike in the US. It's time.
That was Logistics Union C-COBUS leader Daniele Malamachi and TIR activist Diego Biancolin speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about Italy's historic general strike against the genocide in Gaza, the war on Iran, and the economic attacks on workers. That was Pancriti, Bandiera Rossa. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasiliev. A major fight back is underway in St. Louis to stop a white corporate and military land grab in the aftermath of last month's major tornado, which devastated the city's north side Black community. Margaret Flowers spoke with Jason Westbrook, president of the St. Louis International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement branch, and Jesse Neville, chair of the St. Louis Uhuru Solidarity Movement. Westbrook, a lifelong St. Louis resident, began by describing the immediate impact of the tornado and the history of forced displacement of the Black community from many areas of that city.
On May 16th, unfortunately, a tragedy happened. Unfortunately, lack of leadership happened. But May 16th, a tornado, EF3 tornado came to St. Louis and caught the citizens off guard. A lot of us was going on with our everyday life. Some of us was in church. Me and my child, we was outside. I was working on my vehicle. He was playing with the kids, his friends. But a tornado came through without warning. The unfortunate thing about it was the day before, the local government, they test the alarm system, the tornado system, and it a few different times, and it rain came on with no problem. The day of the storm, the tornado, it came with no type of warning. Unfortunately, even the day after, they even pushed the button to retest it, and sure enough, it worked. But the day of, this tornado destroyed 5,000 homes and buildings. The day of the tornado, it caused $1.6 billion damage in our community, the African community, and 7 deaths. One of them was in a church, and they went try to seek refuge within the church, and it came down. All this because of the lack of leadership from the mayor's office. So far, the people have been loving on we've been loving on each other, the citizens of St. Louis. We've been taking care of each other, digging each other up out of the storm, removing branches and stuff up out of the yards, feeding each other. The day the storm happened, Epitum been out there since Saturday, the next day. We've been doing drives, drops. Make a long story short, you've been hearing me saying we are the people. The government have not showed up yet. What they've been doing is shifting blame. What they've been doing is giving false promises. You know, they even told us to do not self-deploy. But if the people would never have self-deployed, we would still be buried within this mess. But now, yes, you see the city is now coming through, trying to erase the evidence of a tornado coming through. But I guess ended with this. Pretty much, even though this tornado caused $1.6 billion damages and 5,000, destroyed 5,000 buildings, unfortunately, this is one of the norms. This is normal for the North Side. And unfortunately, we say that the tornado didn't cause this damage, but policies from City Hall, like benign neglect, teen floor, et cetera, policies from City Hall caused this.
Thank you. So, Comrade Westbrook, in a article that was written in the publication of the African People's Socialist Party, The Burning Spear, talked about how the day before the tornado touched down, the city had put in place a new chief operating officer who's from the military. And in that article, it also writes about the fact that the main response from the city has been a military response. Can you talk about that?
Yes, ma'am. A couple of things. Number one, yes, it's just kind of funny how they put this cat in charge, just responsible for forcing out a lot of Palestinians from homes. We know that many different ways, many different times, they try to force Africans up out of the North Side. One of the ways, one of the times was Mills Creek, one of the other times with JVL with the NGA land grabs. We understand that a lot of the stance that City Hall or the local government been given to the African community has been a militant stance. We could tell, you know, if you look on the news and see the police brutality, military stance. If you look at the force out that they've been, this red tag in the 10 days and the condemning of our buildings has been a military stance. This National Guard, when Spencer, trying to play catch up, asked the National Guards, can they get involved with this cleanup matter? His first response was no, he didn't want the military to, I guess, get their hands dirty with the cleanup because they have to be on standby for security. Make a long story short, this curfew that they put on the people within 5th and 6th District. And we understand that 5th and 6th District was not the only wards or districts that was hit. Clayton was hit, but they don't have no curfew on Clayton. But make a long story short, this military or this militant stance that they always showed the African community. This is one of the norms. This is some of the norms. Right. You know what I mean? Unfortunately, while the people is in need, it seemed like they doing backdoor deals and scripting up plans to do another force out of the community, the African community on the North Side.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is that after the tornado hit, instead of the city coming in, helping the residents clean up, making sure that they had the supplies and things they needed, they sent in National Guard who were not helping, and it's the people that really have had to mobilize and to help each other. Jesse, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit. I know you've written in The Burning Spear about kind of the connections between what's happening in Palestine and what has been traditionally happening in African American communities in the United States. What are your thoughts on what we've talked about so far?
Well, I would say that, you know, the understanding that we have in the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, based on the leadership of Chairman Omalia Shetela and the political understandings of the African People's Socialist Party, is that the connection between what is happening to the Palestinian people and what happens every single day to African people, indigenous people, Mexican people, and other oppressed peoples inside the United States is colonialism. It's one system. It's one mode of production, which is different even from, you know, saying that what we're looking at is a question of racism, which, you know, the chairman explains is the ideas in the minds of white people that we created to justify colonialism. But colonialism is a system. Colonialism is a mode of production that was born from the enslavement of African people and genocide against the native people of this land, and is responsible for the huge gap in wealth that continues to exist between white people in the United States and African people, where the average white family now has about $1.5 million in assets, more than the average African family. And every aspect of life for African people is controlled, dominated by the colonial state power. And that is absolutely evident in what happened in North St. Louis and what's been happening for, as Comrade Westbrook said, for generations in this city. The African community has been targeted for forced population removal, gentrification, police violence, police murder. You know, this is where Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson in 2014. And there was the incredible uprisings at that time. And the story goes back, you know, so many years. You know, President Westbrook referenced the Team 4 plan in the early 1970s, where the city of St. Louis actually hired the Rand Corporation to outline a plan for economic development, which included, quote unquote, triaging the neighborhoods of the city into three categories, one of them being basically the entire African community, which was considered beyond any ability to, quote, save it. They said, we have to make a choice of which neighborhoods to save. So they said their strategy for the north side was, quote unquote, benign neglect. And of course, there was nothing benign about it. It was a deliberate strategy and program to deliberately allow for the conditions and infrastructure in the north side to deteriorate. They called it the let it rot policy. And that's why the infrastructure, even of the poles holding up the lights, you know, the live wires and things like that in the north side for the electricity, the buildings themselves were not able to withstand this tornado. So the tornado, you know, is characterized as an act of nature, but the destruction that came in the wake of that tornado was not the consequence of nature, as the chairman says. It was the consequence of generations, decades of colonial policy by the city of St. Louis that has created the situation where you know, the conditions would be as they are today. And, right. You know, as President Westbrook mentioned, there were other parts of town that were affected by the tornado in the predominantly white areas like Central West End, Forest Park. But the city didn't impose a curfew there. The city didn't red tag all of their buildings and shut off their power. You know, the city did not send the National Guard in there or do any of the other kinds of things that they've done in the north side. And that's why it's so clear that, you know, like the chairman has said, the devastation didn't start with the tornado. They're using the tornado, just like they used the hurricane in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina, as an opportunity, a convenient opportunity to basically finish what they've been doing all along, which is to try to force the Black community out and make St. Louis white. That's what they're trying to do. And that's why the work of the Uhuru movement and the Black Power Blueprint is so important, because it's what stands between the future of African people continuing to live and having the possibility, the capacity for self-determination and prosperity in the city, and the city's plans to basically push them out altogether. And one other thing I would mention, this guy, Ben Johnson, that we were discussing, who was appointed the day before the tornado, Kara Spencer, the mayor, appointed him as the chief of operations. May 15th, which, as some of your listeners may know, is Nakba Day, the day of catastrophe when the illegitimate settler colonial state of Israel formally established itself in 1948 as a consequence of forcible population removal and murder of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian people that has, you know, continued to this very day, as we know. And we can't help but notice the symbolism of that, that she chose a U.S. Air Force colonel on Nakba Day, who was most recently stationed in Gaza to coordinate operations for the city of St. Louis. What kind of operational experience does he bring to the city of St. Louis? Obviously, forced population removal. That's his, you know, counterinsurgency. That's his resume. So I'm really glad that this show is happening, because the people of the world, the eyes of the world, need to be on St. Louis. What is happening in St. Louis right now is extremely serious and extremely urgent. It is Katrina all over again. It is a land grab in progress. And everybody, in particular speaking to white people, need to do everything we can to support the African community here, to stand in solidarity with the right of African people to stay in their communities and to have self-determination and be free from this colonial domination.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely want to get into ways that folks can provide support. But before we do that, Chairman Westbrook, I wonder if you could talk about, you've mentioned red tagging. What exactly is red tagging? What I understand they sent people through to look at the buildings, and then weeks later, on June 2nd, was when they started cutting off the electricity. Can you talk about the process of what the city's been doing in those neighborhoods?
Which wasn't really a process, but pretty much they sent inspectors out to make assessments from the sidewalks, sometimes even from the streets. Sometimes the inspectors just drive by, but a lot of these building assessments are supposed to be checking out the structural stability of the building and see if they either have a roof back, et cetera, or back of the house, or et cetera. You know? But like I say, a lot of times the inspector wasn't inspecting. A lot of times they were just looking from the streets. But so a lot of houses was indiscriminately red tagged. And unfortunately, a lot of the city homes, the LOA homes, which is the largest, the first land bank and the largest land bank here in the country. But a lot of their homes that was dilapidated and derelict and collapsing was missed. Sometimes where it is evident, because a collapsed home from the tornado might have fallen over on their building. So sometimes where it's apparent, they put a tag on. But I did an assessment of myself and I drove around, and a lot of these derelict city homes still exist. But anyhow, this red tag on a lot of citizens, St. Louis citizens' homes that will stand in these homes, we say it was a force out in as many ways on how to force the people out. First, it was 10 days to get on out the house, you know. Then they changed it, which they still have 10 days, because some of these houses could get bulldozed. Over 200 houses is said to be bulldozed. So, but first it was said 10 days. The tag don't necessarily mean get out. That's what they said. But then when they realized the people was not getting out, then they indiscriminately pulled the power on a lot of the houses. A lot of folks got heart defibrillators. A lot of folks have oxygen tanks. A lot of folks just have kids that simply need, you know, social media or the games to calm their nerves because of living through this devastation. But the city indiscriminately pulled the power. Now, a lot of these homes, since the tornado, because of the lack of response from FEMA, lack of response from City Hall, a lack of response from the insurance company, a lot of these folks, unfortunately, had to come out of their pocket. Some of these folks didn't, 70% of the people down here did not have insurance. Mm-hmm. So they had to come out of their pocket. Some folks still living under the devastation because they didn't have the money. But the people, we dug deep and found some money to replace the roofs that was caused by City Hall, replace the bricks and the structural issues that was caused by City Hall. But guess what? They still got red tag, and their power was pulled after the structural issue was fixed. After the structural issue was fixed. So we say that's a militant stance. That's not no stance that a leader should have towards its people, the same people that voted her in. No, that's a force out stance. And like I said, some of the norms, some of the same things we, St. Louis has been faced with for many decades. I mean, I could remember back in the 50s and in the 40s with the Manhattan Projects. I could remember that they gassed the Piragos and the surrounding projects downtown, African community. I mean, they gassed us with radiation and plutonium. But they call it open air study. Do your research. Your research, it's out there. Or right now, once again, with the Manhattan Project, where they buried nuclear waste out in the Bristol areas, in St. Anne area, where you got a nuke underground, and it's next to a waste burial spot. So you got an underground fire that was caused with this waste next to a nuclear burial site. And you have people for many decades now that have been suffering from the conditions out there. This is the conditions that the city government has put us in. And they've been, I guess, washed their hands on us. And 30,000 residents, black residents, has been forced out of St. Louis. I guess they would try any means necessarily to cause a force out to justify the North Side, any means.
Sounds terrible. I mean, they were condemning homes that without actually properly assessing them. And then when people didn't leave and people were repairing their homes, they went ahead and just turned the power off on folks. Now, I understand that there is quite a lot of money that the city could be putting in to help out folks in those neighborhoods so they could stay in their homes. Is that something that you've approached the city about, getting access to funds?
There's money, like you're saying, from the Rams funds, from the Rams interest, from the Harper fund, I mean, from the city surplus. There's money to address the immediate needs for the people. But the thing is, now we have to have certain debates that allocate some of the money. What is the holdup?
Right.
What is the holdup? Once again, because they don't want the community that was devastated to stay there. They want these particular affected areas to be gentrified. So yes, it's a lot of money. But you see politicians in Jefferson City talking about giving the baseball team and Kansas City Chiefs tax incentives and abatements and stuff like that. But these are the type of discussions that we are having in a time like this. And forget allocating some of the money. Forget this debate. Turn all that money loose. Because you already said out of your mouth that it's going to be $1.6 billion. So $20 million here, $100,000 there is not even enough to even entertain this type of conversation. Release all of the money to the African community. We know for many decades, money was exploited out of the African community. We know many decades, red line. We understand that terminology, red line, which is a real thing. Folks, African community was subjugated to this particular area. And not only that, but finances was restricted to coming to this particular area. But for many decades, finances be extracted, exploited out of this neighborhood. So it just turned that money loose, turned that money back to the African community. The North Side, the devastated side. That's all I'm saying.
Right. Yes. Thank you. Jesse, do you want to make any comments about that?
Yeah, I just completely agree with President Westbrook. And these funds have to be released to the African community. And this, the mayor, Kara Spencer, I think it was last year, maybe earlier this year, before she was elected, she came to a meeting at the Uhuru House in the North Side, and she was invited to a community forum. And she spoke, and I distinctly remember she stood up there and she said, "The city is flush with cash."
That was Jason Westbrook, president of the St. Louis branch of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, and Jesse Neville, chair of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, speaking to Margaret Flowers, host of Clearing the Fog on WBAI. We thank volunteers at Pacifica affiliate station WBPU, Black Power 96 in St. Petersburg, Florida, for production assistance. More information on the Uhuru Movement's work to clean up and rebuild St. Louis's Northside Black community is at blackpowerblueprint.org. Lastly, as we produced this show, we were deeply disturbed to learn that African Stream, an independent African media outlet, has shut down. Shortly before Joe Biden left office, his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, attacked the outlet, alleging that it was an agent of the Kremlin in Africa. This triggered a wave of censorship. Within days, YouTube, Meta, Google, and TikTok removed African Stream accounts, and X demonetized them. Even their personal accounts were restricted, and Blue Sky eventually banned them as well. These actions shattered their ability to survive financially, creating an uphill battle every day until they were forced to close. Executive editor Ahmed Caballo thanked all the outlet's supporters on X, the only social media platform that was still allowing them to post content. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Anne Garrison, Thomas O'Rourke, Steve Zelter, and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.